Just about anybody over the age of 10 has heard about the story of Romeo and Juliet, the star-crossed teens who fall deeply in love despite a long-standing feud between their families. It does not end well for them. The original play by William Shakespeare has been staged more times than anyone can count and adapted into other works like West Side Story. Today's guest adapted the story but expanded it greatly, too. Lois Levine wrote her own novel around one of the characters in the play. The book is called Juliet's Nurse, and it's now out in paperback. Lois Levine gets around. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, several other publications, and on NPR. She's the author of another novel, The Secrets of Mary Bowser. Juliet's Nurse came out in hardcover last year and is just released in paperback. Lois describes herself as living in Portland with two cats, one Canadian, and 60,000 honeybees. Lois Levine, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
I read that you were thinking of a novel on American history. How did it turn into this?
Well, my first novel, The Secrets of Mary Bowser, is essentially a footnote for my dissertation based on the true story of a woman who was a spy for the Union during the Civil War by pretending to be a slave in the Confederate White House. So I love doing historical research, but there wasn't enough information about her life to write a biography. So I wrote a novel, and I say I'm an accidental novelist. Mm-hmm. I became a novelist to write that story. So I had assumed that I would keep writing kind of these footnotes from American history. I love this way to teach people history, but through a character-driven story. And I was working on a project, and it wasn't coming together. And I had worked on it one morning for 4 hours. And I get up and I write before I even brush my teeth or eat or, you know, have a cup of tea.
Wow, that's dedication.
So I thought, well, okay, I'm going to, 4 hours, that's enough for now. I'm going to go brush my teeth. And as I was walking across the room, literally the title Juliet's Nurse came to me. And I thought, well, that sounds great. I wonder if it sounds so good because somebody's written that book and nobody had and there was no movie. And so I did something that I hadn't done since high school, freshman year of high school, which is that I pulled the play off the shelf and I actually read the play. Like most people, I'd seen many productions, including film as well as stage productions. But when you read the play, I mean, part of it is it lets you slow down and look at one particular character. And she was amazing in the very first scene of the play that Juliet is in is also the nurse's first scene. Juliet has 8 lines. The nurse has over 60. So clearly this is a woman who has been waiting to tell her story. And one of the things that happens in this scene, Lady Capulet sort of says in an offhand manner, you know how old my daughter is. And the nurse, whose name is Angelica, it's given just once in the play, Angelica replies and says, yes, of course I know her age. My daughter was the same age but didn't live. And as soon as I read that, I thought, oh my, there is a story here. The death of a child is the most profound and devastating loss that somebody could experience. And then to have another child to nurture in this, not just emotionally, but very physically intimate way. She's breastfeeding this other child, but you're also always a servant in her house. So I wanted to know that story. And in that same speech, I say it's almost like watching the embarrassing home movies of Juliet's childhood, because she talks about the day that Juliet was weaned. She talks about her husband, who is now dead, and you know, him basically telling a dirty joke, which is very Shakespearean, to Juliet. And there were all of these characters and stories that I just realized could come to life if you start that story not, you know, 4 or 5 days before it all ends tragically. Spoiler alert.
Right.
Juliet does not live happily ever after. But rather, you know, the play takes place in a matter of days. And by starting many years earlier, you could understand not just Angelica, the nurse, but all these other characters who we meet in a sort of very intense moment. But they have amazing stories once you start to really imagine them.
Did Shakespeare leave any other versions of Romeo and Juliet around that expanded even further upon the nurse character? She sounds like she's just a treasure trove, really.
No, I don't know why he gives her that much backstory and then sort of doesn't play on any of it later. There are other sources that he had that he drew on. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really feel compelled to look at all of them or to research Shakespeare's life. I wanted to take the play. And certainly for people who know the play well, the novel has all sorts of fun in jokes. But I also wanted to write it for people who, quite honestly, like me, haven't read it maybe since high school, don't remember anything beyond, oh yeah, those kids, I don't think they live happily ever after.
Right.
But I really wanted to imagine what it would be like to experience those events from a particular point of view, and also to bring in maybe some more of the rich historical detail. Shakespeare is a wonderful writer. But he's not always the best historian. So he's very sloppy. You know, they're fighting with rapiers, which didn't actually exist in the time.
Two centuries later, right?
That the novel is set. So So some of it, the challenge and fun for me, because I am a pointy-headed geek, is getting to go back and do that research. What was it like to live in the 14th century in Italy, whether you were very wealthy, as Juliet's family would have been, or not so wealthy, as Angelica was?
And the level of detail is quite profound, and we'll get to that in just a little bit. So you're not a Shakespeare scholar. For that matter, does it help this project that you don't have some of the attachments to the rules, air quotes, of Shakespeare?
I think part of it is that I was either courageous or foolish to take on probably certainly the best known play in the English language, maybe the best known literary work in the English language. And I didn't have any qualms about it because I didn't really think about it like, oh, Shakespeare. So it probably gave me courage or false courage. But, you know, my academic training is interesting. My PhD is really in a literature department, but I am very much trained with doing a lot of historical research. But the literary training meant that I could look at the play and find things that don't quite make sense. There's a point in the play where Angelica refers to Tybalt, who's Juliet's cousin, as the best friend I ever had. Well, this is fascinating because there's not a single scene in the play that they're both in. Aside from that line, they never talk about each other. And they're separated by gender, by age, he's much younger than she is, and by class. So what exactly is their friendship like? Well, as a literary scholar, you can only wonder about that. As a novelist, I get to imagine what 14 years of friendship might look like between the two of them.
And the scene in which Tybalt and Angelica meet is a lot of fun to read. It's just sort of one of those, like, you know, the kid playing around the window thing. Hey, who are you? You know, and they get into a conversation and off they go. A lot of fun in the book, Juliet's Nurse. Lois Levine wrote it. She's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with her. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone or by email at jx@jeffnet.org. A whole lot more to talk about Romeo and Juliet, and most importantly, Juliet's Nurse, with Lois Levine and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about one of Shakespeare's characters greatly expanded in her own novel. Juliet's Nurse is the name of the novel. Angelica is the name of the character. The author is Lois Levine from Portland, and she's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange in Ashland for a reading of Juliet's Nurse tonight at 7 o'clock at Bloomsbury Books, and some other events involving her earlier book that we'll get to a little later on in the program. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about Romeo and Juliet and this horrible, horrible mangling that Lois Levine has given to it. She really hasn't. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, by email jx@jeffnet.org. And the horrible, horrible mangling is definitely a caricature, but there are people who would probably take umbrage at, oh my God, you can't take Shakespeare's character and expand upon it like this. Other people have, though. I mean, was there much trepidation?
You know, it's very interesting who I hear from about this book, because some of the most interesting comments I get are from actors. Actors certainly who are playing the nurse and are excited to have more backstory. I mentioned Tybalt, and one nurse said, oh, yeah, and I gave the book to Tybalt, meaning the actor playing Tybalt in that production, because I thought that, you know, Tybalt seems so angry, and now you get to sort of see him as a much more loving and full character. So I think that actors are always doing this with characters. They're thinking about, how did this person come to be in this situation, and why, what's their take on everything that's happening? So in some ways, it is a very traditional thing to do with a character from a play, to imagine their fuller backstory or imagine how they're responding specifically to everything that's going on around them. One of the most interesting sort of, oh my heavens, how have you mangled it sort of responses that I get is about the treatment of Romeo. We think of Romeo as a very romantic hero, and I will say that in the novel, not necessarily that depiction, but there's really nothing in the novel that isn't in the play. Part of what happens is that we learn things in a particular order in the play, and when you write first-person fiction, your narrator, and thus your readers, can only learn things when the narrator experiences them, whether she sees it, hears it, or hears somebody else talk about it. So she gets information in a different order because she's not there as it's all happening. And so everything that I write about Romeo is true. That is to say, is in the play. I mean, true. But that it's interesting to think about what happens when you see it just from one character's point of view. One of the other challenges, of course, is that even when you think you don't remember Romeo and Juliet, you do. You remember "Wherefore art thou, Romeo?" And many of the most famous lines in the play are uttered when the nurse is not on stage. I know that readers will want to hear those lines, especially, you know, just to feel like, oh yeah, I'm smart. I remember Romeo and Juliet. And so how do I work those in? Well, you know, if you have a lovesick teenage girl, she's probably going to be repeating things that her boyfriend said to her, right? So that the nurse can overhear it that way. But I think trying to write for the amount of familiarity readers might have was one of the challenges here.
Given that, I mean, did you find any places where you were coming into conflict with Shakespeare's story?
Well, I mentioned the swords, and that's a really good one, because it's not just that, you know, they were fighting with long swords rather than rapiers. It was that characters couldn't die with the speed with which he, you know, gets rid of them. You get stabbed and you're gone.
Right.
Well, that depends on the weapon that you're using. So he sometimes bent the rules a little bit to accommodate Shakespeare, because he, you know, it is his story, and I want to respect that. And then, again, picking up on some of the little tidbits that he gave, I always say, even if you think you don't remember anything about the play, you remember Mercutio's dying words, "A plague on both their houses." That was a great clue for me when I was trying to decide when to set my novel. Plague first came to Italy in 1348, and it killed about 40% of the population. Now, imagine that happening, you know, in our own world, if 40% of the state or the country suddenly died. We know a lot about infection, and it would freak us out. But for people who had no idea why some people got sick and some people survived, how terrifying that must have been. And I set the novel not during the plague, but 10 years after, so that you have this intense period of loss. And then it seems like everything has gone back to normal. And again, you know, they don't have ideas like post-traumatic stress disorder or survivor's guilt. How are they making sense of the world? And to me, putting the particulars of what happens with these families up against this broader cultural sense of devastating loss made for some really intense emotional interactions between the characters.
Lois Levine is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's taken the nurse from Romeo and Juliet and put her in her own novel, Juliet's Nurse. The poignancy of loss is felt very profoundly by the reader, and certainly by Juliet's nurse, because I've ended up counting on my fingers, like, oh, wait a minute, you're naming off the names of the kids she's lost to the plague. And it's very moving. And I guess you realize that this is what drives her then, loss of child after child after child, into, and you point out again, it's Capaletti household.
Yeah, and may I read a bit about that?
Sure, go ahead.
Oh, great. I'm going to find a good passage with that in mind.
There's one on page 18 and 19 about how she's taken into the Capaletti household.
I think I'm going to talk a little bit actually earlier,
mm-hmm.
Because, again, Shakespeare sort of starts her off already having experienced the loss of her daughter, and I wanted to sort of slow it down and imagine what that would be like. So this happens after she's been delivered of her daughter, and she sort of has suspected that something is wrong, but this is her first interaction with her husband, Pietro. When next I wake, the room is filled with golden light and all Verona smells of yeasty bread. It is Lammas Day, a harvest feast, sown seeds reaped as grain, then ground and baked to rounded loaves. Pietro, red-eyed and bewildered, kneels beside our bed, tearing small pieces of the blessed bread, dipping some in honey, some in wine, feeding each to me. Could anything be so sweet against the metallic taste of grief? He slips his hands beneath me, his palms warm against the ache across my back. Susanna is... I shake my head, cutting him off. I will not let him say the word, will not make myself listen. Why could we two not just be alone like we'd been the seasons past and happy? The plague that stole our other children laid half the city dead, but this fresh loss comes to us alone. This is grief's great trick, You think you've faced the worst of it, not dreaming of all that is yet to come. Pietro wets a cloth and washes me, dresses me, rebraids the great length of my hair and covers it. Then he guides me to my feet and leads me down the stairs and through Verona's crooked streets. Sore and stiff, I move slowly, but what aches most drives me on as I hold Pietro's arm, repeating to myself the promise he whispered as he lifted me from our bed. There is a baby waiting, needing me as much as I need her.
And this is from Juliet's Nurse by Lois Levine, reading here in the Jefferson Exchange. The baby who needs her is, of course, Juliet. Pietro's a wonderful character, too. I mean, they're all so well-drawn. I mean, I love him almost instantly. He's just this big, lusty bear of a man who just dotes on his wife amazingly so.
Yeah, and, you know, again, all we know from Shakespeare is he was a merry man and that he's dead. So I have a lot of rain. And I wanted to imagine somebody, yes, who was a merry man, loving and lustful, but also experiencing loss in a very different way. And obviously, if she has Juliet to be her comfort, he doesn't. And in a way, he loses his wife because she goes off to live with this other family. And I say it's, kind of the work-life balance that working women always have, but in medieval Italy.
Right. It definitely, she has to give all of her time over. You get right into some of the other gritty details of the day, you know, lice and bed bugs and greased dowels from the midwife. I mean, yeah. Was there, I mean, as you were searching some of this, were there some things that were just so gross you couldn't bring yourself to put into your book?
You know, I think that part of the fun for me is getting to read medical guides and court cases and journals and all sorts of things from the period, looking at the art. I traveled to Verona, Italy to do research, which any of your listeners who've traveled to Italy know what an awful sacrifice that was for me.
Right.
To have to go.
Terrible.
And I think that it's not that anything was too gross. There were one or two things where either my agent or my editor said, oh, that is really, do you need that? Okay, maybe it could go. But maybe part of it is that we tend to romanticize the past, right? And to think about what life was like. I mean, even cities had, like pigs would be wandering through the city streets or goats. And we don't think of that in terms of urban life. So, which is great because I think one of the advantages I have that Shakespeare didn't is the ability to describe places. So even in that scene that I just read, smells and tastes come up. And I think that that's a great way to draw readers in. So the gross details can be a little bit off-putting. I try and balance them with a little bread dipped in honey and wine.
That is, yeah, it's a lot. And Pietro actually makes candies, doesn't he? Confections.
He is a beekeeper, mm-hmm. And that was sort of an accidental choice on my part. I wanted him to have a profession.
Well, you live with 60,000 bees yourself, as you've described, so you know this a bit.
Well, actually, the novel calls it the bees. Mm-hmm. When I made him a beekeeper somewhat randomly. Beekeeping would be important both for honey, which was a major sweetener in food, but also because of the wax, that beeswax candles were sort of the fanciest candles you could have. So think of the fancy lighting store in your town, and that's where they'd be selling the beeswax candles. But then I had to learn something about bees. And the more I learned, the more important they became in the novel, not just in terms of plot, where things happen around taking care of the hives, but actually thematically, that this is the part where people say I sound like a crazy cat lady, but with insects. Please indulge me. I think part of what's fascinating for beekeepers about honeybees is hive mentality, that when you see a bee out foraging for pollen or for nectar, they're not doing that because they're going to make honey that they will eat themselves. They're making either honey or food for the brood that it will be consumed by bees after they are gone. So they think about the good of the hive. For those people who have been to Italy or other European cities and seen the beautiful cathedrals, there's sort of a metaphor there. The people who designed the cathedrals or who began building them knew that they were never going to worship in those buildings, but they felt like they were part of something bigger than themselves, even though it might take years or centuries to build those cathedrals. And I think that that's part of how, you know, Shakespeare kills every character that my character loves. I always say, if you're upset, please write your angry emails to Shakespeare. Right. That is not my fault. I can only work with what he gave me. How do you find hope in a story with so much tragedy and so much loss? And I think the bees helped me figure that out, thinking about being part of something bigger than yourself, or that we don't measure loss in terms of an immediate, but think about the survival of the hive, as it were.
The book is Juliet's Nurse. It's now in paperback. Lois Levine from Portland is its author. She joins us here in the studio on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can join the conversation. 800-838-3760 by phone around the listening area. 800-838-3760. The email address, if you'd like to join us that way, jx@jeffnet.org. You talked about Juliet's Nurse, Angelica, moving into the Capaletti household. And having to be part of it. I mean, is this the way it was? Any wet nurse is bound breast to baby until the child weans?
It really depended. And sometimes actually you would send your child off to a wet nurse and maybe not see your child for months or even years, which seems very strange to us. Having a wet nurse was actually fairly common. It wasn't just very wealthy families. In fact, sometimes a woman would send her child off to the countryside to be nursed so that she could become the nurse to another family in the city. It's, you know, it's economics. That's the sort of choices that they were making. I wanted to put Angelica in this household in part because when you come to Romeo and Juliet, the play, it's a little bit weird. This child is 14 years old, and we know from that first speech that she's been weaned for 11 years. So why is the woman who breastfed her even hanging around the house? So I have to kind of find a place for her in that house. And it is also, as a fiction writer, always a wonderful circumstance when you can start a book with your character walking into a new setting, because it gives that character an excuse to observe everything and comment on everything. So this is a woman who is from a family that is not wealthy or not politically powerful, walking into a household of people who are wealthy and are politically powerful, and her having to figure out what she thinks about them. And also understand that they are not, in some ways they are incredibly different and in some ways not, that the plague affects everybody. So in living in the aftermath of the plague, thinking about how loss resonates across the wealthy as well as the poor and what that means for everyone's experience, that's part of her arc as a character. It's not just what she thinks about these rich people, but how what she thinks about them changes over time.
That's one of the most fascinating parts of the book to me in the early reading, is just the idea that Juliet, as instructed by Lord Capaletti to Angelica, Juliet is her superior, but she's giving Juliet life in a very physical sense. She's breastfeeding her. And so she's actually subservient to this baby she's breastfeeding, but she's also still got enough heart to feel like, to feel the sense of maternal sweetness toward Juliet's mother, who is a teenager herself still and not very happy about giving birth at this age and living with old Lord Capaletti and everything. And yet she's just got this amazing reservoir of compassion when she clearly is sort of an asterisk in terms of society, at least in the view of the likes of Lord Capaletti.
Well, of course, every character thinks that they are the center of their own story, and she has no problem with that, even in Shakespeare's play. I mean, I think that's why she's such a scene stealer and always putting her, you know, Tybalt was my best friend, always putting herself in the middle. So she was wonderful to have as a narrator. And again, just try and think about those other characters. We know from Shakespeare's play that Lady Capulet says to Juliet, you know, I was not much older than you when I was a wife and mother maid. So that was something that I really wondered about, to be so young and be in this household and be in some ways a position of power and in other ways completely powerless, because she doesn't have much choices about her life. In that time period, women really didn't get to go out into the world, and it was harder on wealthy women because poor women had to. But if you were a wealthy woman, you might be kept inside your house almost all of the time, except when there was a religious service to go to, or some reason that you were being put on display to show the wealth and power of your family. So she does learn to be compassionate towards, she says, you know, she's in need of mothering herself, new mother though she is. So Angelica is compassionate towards this woman, but also they are rivals. And that happens more and more over time as Juliet gets older. When I first thought about this novel, part of me thought, oh, you know, I could actually set this in, you know, the contemporary United States. This could be a nanny on the Upper East Side in New York, maybe not breastfeeding, but giving up her own child to take care of another family's child. But I loved the historical research too much to not want to delve into the 14th century, though I do think that some of these questions about taking care of other people's children or the relationship that families have to the caregivers for their children is really very resonant today.
We have an email here from Debbie in Talent. She writes, I read and loved The Secrets of Mary Bowser. Thanks, it is the best historical fiction I've read. When you describe how the idea for Juliet's nurse came to you, I wondered if you could entertain the idea of a muse or some kind of external source from which ideas come in a whole piece.
You know, I would love to believe in that because I would like to think that there's somebody else who is responsible for thinking about not just what book to write next, but what to put in the book. And that some of these things, you know, I mentioned the honeybees, which I don't know where that came from to make him a beekeeper. It became so important. I can't imagine this novel without it. And when I went back and reread Romeo and Juliet for about the 10,000th time, I realized that there's a point where Juliet calls the nurse honey nurse. Wow. Wow. So you do kind of want to believe that there was some force in the universe, the muse that brought this to me. But writing is also, for your listeners who do it, an awful lot of hard work. So if there is a muse, I would like it to be working longer hours so I can work shorter hours.
To give you more ideas completely formed. While we're talking about The Secrets of Mary Bowser, you mentioned before we got on the air about doing some events in Grants Pass about that book.
Yes. Josephine Community Library is hosting a Civil War weekend. So I think it's 4:30 p.m. on Friday. We're going to be talking about glory and the Civil War through film. And then I think it's 9 in the morning on Saturday. I'm going to be doing a workshop more focused on The Secrets of Mary Bowser and teaching Civil War history through fiction.
All right. And of course, tonight at 7 o'clock at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland, talking about Juliet's Nurse, which we have another 15 minutes to talk about when we come back from a break. Back with Lois Levine and your phone calls and emails on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Lois Levine from Portland. She is a novelist twice now. She is the author of The Secrets of Mary Bowser, about the Union spy who lived in Jefferson Davis's house in the Confederate White House during the Civil War. Her latest work, now out in paperback, is called Juliet's Nurse, in which she takes Angelica, the nurse from Romeo and Juliet, and expands her greatly into her own work. And we get to learn a lot about what goes on in the Capuletti household through the eyes of Juliet's nurse. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Lois about the book, 800-838-3760 around the region, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. We talked about the way in which Angelica is so bound to Juliet and really doesn't even see her husband Pietro for a while. The circumstance in which she gets away is rather funny. It's one of those, like, you know, I have the religious procession I have to go to. I will take the baby there and get her to the front of the crowd to get the blessing of the bishop or something.
Yes. If you're trying to get somebody out of the house in medieval Italy, one thing you can count on is the Catholic Church, or as it was then known, the Church. Mm-hmm. Thinking about her relationship to that, because again, even in Shakespeare's play, the nurse is always justifying her own actions. And of course, one of the other major minor characters in the play is Friar Lawrence. And to make them all more Italian, I changed his name to Friar Lorenzo in the novel. But thinking about both the way in which they are kind of bound together and in cahoots, and the way that he then becomes another rival for Angelica over time.
He actually sets up her employment in the Capuletti household, doesn't he?
Yes, and that thinking about what it would be like to live in that time period. I mean, really, the church was the place that you learned everything. There were no schools. And it was a worldview that everybody supposedly shared. So having Angelica figure out how to, how to confess her lustful sins with her husband in just the right way to Friar Lorenzo, as she says, you know, making sure to mention the phrases conjugal bed and marital duty as often as I can, so that she is always doing what she thinks is the right thing to do, even around her own sins.
But in essence, she's gone shopping for the person to tell her confession to, right?
Yes, although I already knew who she had to purchase because Shakespeare made that choice.
That is true. You had some things to go with there. You had to make some decisions about Angelica's relationships with other members of the household, and not everyone gets along with everyone. So interesting process, I would think. And Shakespeare helped with some of it and not with other parts of it. Is that right?
Well, you know, again, what do we really know about these people? And I feel like I will say, and I will distinguish between Romeo and Juliet by saying Lord Capulet as opposed to Capuletto. I use the Italian version. In Romeo and Juliet, we all have this impression of Lord Capulet as an awful jerk because, you know, they're keeping the lovers apart. Well, actually, he doesn't know that Juliet even knows Romeo. When Romeo crashes the party in the play, very early in the play, he crashes the Capulet family party. Tybalt is upset and wants to throw him out. And Lord Capulet says, you know, no, as a host, I have certain things that I should do. And he doesn't seem like a bad kid. So we don't know if Juliet had come clean to her father, what he would have said about Romeo. Certainly in the novel, he is an antagonist for Angelica because he's the head of the household where she is a servant. And most servants aren't necessarily going to love the head of the household. But again, over time, she learns more about him. In the play, he has a line very early on. He's talking to Paris, who's courting Juliet, about Juliet. And he says, "The earth has swallowed all my hopes but she." Well, this is this teeny little hint Shakespeare gives us of how much loss this family has undergone. What were those other hopes? Who were those other children? How did the earth swallow them? So I get to imagine that and try and make him a more complex character than just the mean old dad who doesn't let his teenage daughter have any fun, which is sort of the way that we remember him, maybe more through film even than the play today.
Are you a fairly ruthless editor with your own stuff? And I ask this because I think about the level of detail that you give to the two assistants to the midwife, the twins, the weirdo twins who help the midwife deliver Angelica's stillborn baby. But then I also remember that there are some nurses by the bedside of Juliet when she first enters the Capuletti household, who I know nothing about. And it's that level of like, okay, well, you probably told a bit about them too. And went, oh my God, this is going to be like the Count of Monte Cristo and run to three volumes. So off goes the slicing.
You know, when you write historical fiction, your two greatest fears are that either that you learn so much historical detail, you want to cram it in there and you have what the editor calls the info dump, which means you've done too much research, or that you've done too little research when you write something that is completely improbable, right? If Tybalt took a trip to the moon, that would be problematic. But I am a ruthless editor. People will often ask, so how many drafts did you do? And I say, if you can still count the number of drafts, you are not done yet. As I said, I write every morning first thing, and then I will go back and edit usually at the end of the day and again in the morning. And then, you know, as the pages amass, I go back over and over and over it. I think that that the opportunity to get into characters' heads and, as I said, to be very appealing to all the senses, very sensory in the description of smells and tastes as well as what is seen and heard, that's one of the great advantages that a novelist has. Poor Shakespeare. I feel bad for him. He was writing, you know, before they invented the novel. Sometimes he seems really to want to do it. Hamlet has all of those big soliloquies. It's because he can't do internal narration. He wants to tell us what Hamlet's thinking. So instead, this guy's to stand on the stage and talk to himself over and over again. I get to be entirely in my character's head and really want to exploit that in every way, including having her sometimes misjudge characters or believe things that aren't true, that how do you, as a writer, signal to your reader that, oh, this narrator may be telling you things that she believes are true, but you shouldn't necessarily believe them.
Interesting. So the possibility that the person who sees all, at least from her own perspective, could be wrong.
I know it's hard to believe since we never have that experience in our own lives, but sometimes what you think is going on isn't really what's going on.
We're talking to Lois Levine about her novel, Juliet's Nurse, about Angelica, who is the nurse for Juliet in Romeo and Juliet. So Shakespeare expanded here on the Jefferson Exchange. In the language of the play, which is Shakespearean language, and it is very much Shakespeare's style, iambic pentameter and all that, what choices did you have to make about what people would sound like when they talk to each other in the novel?
Yeah, well, I used to be on the faculty at UCLA and then at Reed College, and I have forced students to read Shakespeare. And let's just say I didn't want my readers necessarily to feel about my novel as those students did about having to read the play. So it is.
They thanked you for it later, though,
yes.
I'm sure.
I hope. I wanted it to sound like it was from a different era, but not difficult to decipher. And, you know, when you go to see a play, which I understand some of your listening audience has the opportunity to do fairly regularly at one of the best Shakespeare festivals in the country, when you go to see a play, I think even if you miss a line here or there, it's easier to to keep up because you have the energy of the actors. You see how they're interacting. And it feels like, okay, the first few minutes, it takes me a little bit of time to fall in, but then I'm in. With a novel, I think people who get frustrated, you know, they don't have to stay in their seats. They can put the book down and go do anything else. So I wanted it to feel accessible, but also to bring in some of those lines, you know, that are so familiar, but work them in a way that felt like they made sense in something that isn't all written in Shakespearean dialogue. So I fiddled with some of his lines. There's a line that I use, "What's tomb is womb." And actually, as I wrote, I forgot that that wasn't from the play. And then I went back and I looked at the play again. And Friar Lawrence says something like that in one of his first speeches. But it's much longer and it's harder to parse. And Shakespeare could expect that his audience would follow that. But I kind of condensed it to get at what I think is essentially the same feel. Out of death comes life. And that really becomes another one of the major themes of the novel.
Were there any characters in the play that you felt you either wanted to elevate by having them rise in the esteem of Angelica, Juliet's nurse, or that you wanted to take down a peg because you thought they were such jerks in the play that you wanted to really show that they were just sleazy, skeezy boneheads?
Would you mean Romeo? I mean, I really look at the play. If you're going to read both, read the novel first because it'll help you see things in the play that you might not otherwise. But if you go back to the play, Romeo, as I say, he is not a guy you want dating your 14-year-old daughter. Just, I promise you that. So certainly Romeo, just to kind of elevate what's going on in the play, Tybalt, who becomes this heartbreaker. I mean, I think that he in some ways grows more as a character in Juliet's Nurse than anybody else, just because we don't meet him as the angry young man who just wants to fight everybody, but see how he becomes that, how he's shaped.
He's a sweet kid when you first meet him. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a darling. And Mercutio, who is such a bad boy, he was a real pleasure to work with, too, because I could use him to bring out things. And that's one of the things you do as a novelist. If you want to talk about big things that are going on in a historical moment, you have to use particular characters to do that. And he was a very enjoyable character to work with in that way.
So Angelica and Romeo, I'm trying to figure out the dynamic here. I did not get to the back of the book. Is she trying to keep Juliet away from Romeo? Is she trying to let this happen? And how do her feelings about the heads of the Capuletti household lead to her decisions?
Well, she, of course, wants to put herself in the middle of everything. And I think that that's why she's such a good go-between in the play. Mm. But in the play, there's a scene, you know, she's the one who brings them together, who tells Juliet when she can sneak off to marry Romeo, that then after the marriage, she helps Romeo sneak into the house so they can consummate the marriage. And that makes it not just legally, but morally binding. Again, remember, the church is such a governing force in people's lives. And in the play, she does all of that and then comes in the morning and basically warns Juliet, your mother's coming, you better get him out of the room. And then she goes off stage and then Lady Capulet comes in and says, great news, after Romeo's gone, your father's decided that you're getting married this Thursday to Paris. And then Lord Capulet comes in and the nurse is with him and says, yep, you're getting married. And it's a horrible scene because Juliet says, I won't marry him. And Lord Capulet says, I'll throw you out of the house. This is it. You are mine and I give you to my friend. And so then the parents go out and Juliet turns to the nurse and says, what am I going to do? And she says, I think you should marry Paris. Now, this is a very strange thing for her to say, because unlike the Capulets, she knows that Juliet is already married, that it would be not just illegal, but immoral. And we're talking about the state of your forever soul if she gets married. So I feel like something must have happened while she was off stage to change her opinion. And that was another one of the great seeds of the novel, was what could happen off stage at that moment that would change the person who, yeah, she's opposed to the parents. So she has been the secret go-between because she feels like this shows that she's the one who really loves and cares for Juliet. What makes her change her mind? And I will not say another word about that so that you get to the end of the book.
Fair enough. Is there a section in the late in the book that you wanted to read a portion of?
Yeah, you know, one of the things, spoiler alert, again, things don't work out well for Juliet. When you write historical fiction, you're always writing about a specific moment, but also from a particular moment. And so when I was thinking about how do I deal with Juliet's death, I was thinking about suicide today and actually how people respond to suicide. And a family member of mine who lost a partner to suicide, who told me, you know, you get really angry about it. And so that helped me as I was thinking about how the nurse would respond. So this is from nearly the end of the book. The days are short, the winter long, and on many of these darkened days I hate her. How could I not? She took everything. Everything I gave, everything I had or thought I had. Not just took, killed. The bloodied violence of it, that is what maddens me. How she drove the dagger in, how she'd not cared who she hurt with that single stab. Not cared for anything but Romeo, not cared for me. I raised 6 sons and then reared Tybalt. Watch boys turn to men, and you'll learn how they are drawn to danger. But I'd not known how fragile a girl can grow in the season she starts to ripen into a woman. This is what shatters my heart over and over again, that I'd not known, not seen, not ever sensed how fragile she was, how she could be so unlike me. My father's beatings, the first great plague, my husband's sudden death, bit by terrible bit, every awful thing that ever happened to me taught me to survive. Not like my girl, who never suffered. Never suffered because I was ever near to tend her. Never suffered, and so could not bear the slightest sorrow, the hint of unfilled longing, the least glimmering of loss. And so was lost herself. Should I have let her suffer? Would it have taught her to survive? Or was it better to keep her short life always sweet, sweet as a taste of honey on the tongue? You cannot live long on only honey. You cannot survive without tasting much that's bitter. Wormwood coats life's dug, and that's where we must suckle. There's a good Shakespearean word for you, Doug. As I always tell my audiences, is Shakespeare speak for boob.
Uh-huh.
And in the play, we know that actually wormwood applied to the nipple was how Juliet was weaned. So this is a place where I get to come back to Shakespeare's language, but also maybe address this theme of, we know that suicide rates are actually on the rise now, especially among teenagers. And thinking about this book, as I'm only realized, you know, when I was well into writing it, this is a book about surviving not just the death of a child, but the death of a child to suicide, and how I could create something for my readers that was hopeful out of such awful loss.
Well, it's an amazing work, and obviously successful enough in hardcover to make it to paperback. Juliet's Nurse is the book. Lois Levine is the author. Thank you so much for joining us today at the Jefferson Exchange.
It's been a pleasure.
7 o'clock tonight at Bloomsbury Books if you want to see Lois in person, and then she'll be doing the Civil War events this weekend in Grants Pass, 4:30 Friday and 9:30 on Saturday morning. Thanks again so much.